Welcome to the Grand Prix 24/7 podcast, your weekly insight into the world of Formula One. Thank you for listening to the Grand Prix 24/7 podcast. I'm your host, Will, and today I'll be joined by Gary Sloan, a contributor to the Grand Prix 24/7 website. Gary has a vast background in Formula One, especially on the business side, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk about some of the upcoming things off the track facing Formula One in the next few months. So I guess before we get started really on some of the topics that we discussed earlier, it'd just be great if you could kind of give our listeners a little bit of background on your career and the work that you've done in Formula One in the past.
Well, I've been a very passionate Formula One fan for, I have to say, over 40 years. During that time, as much as I enjoyed the racing and followed it, I was equally intrigued by the growth of the sport as a business under the circus master Bernie Eccleston. So I watched with, I've always been involved in business myself, so I equally was interested in that. And then from that, I had a background in fraud investigation, not committing it. And I sort of tallied up the three things, going digging for a good story. The business side of Formula One, and probably its underbelly and murky side, and maybe some of the less savoury things that go on. And that led to the accumulation of the book.
Fascinating. And you currently do the Inside the Pit Lane column on the Grand Prix 24/7 website. So I guess the place to start was, obviously, this is in itself a completely unprecedented season within Formula One. We obviously travelled to Melbourne for the first race of the season and then were unable to get going due to the outbreak of the coronavirus. And I just wanted to get your stand on this season, kind of the logistical achievement by Liberty Media to make it work, and also just some of the financial ramifications of no fans and the delay that happened and the fact that we aren't going to get as many races perhaps they previously wanted.
Yeah, I mean, it's unprecedented times we're in. It's very hard to quantify a lot of it. I think the first thing to say is that Liberty, to be fair to them, probably have pulled off what many folk, including myself, thought wasn't possible, which was to go and travel around all these countries during a pandemic with all the restrictions. So I think on their part, of course, it was, without underestimating, it was probably survival. They needed to get a season going. They could have survived financially for the year. They've got enough back in there and they have their banks over a stranglehold the way their debts are signed up. But it was really the teams that provide their product, they were going into meltdown. And we could have quite easily lost four teams, no problem whatsoever. So they really had to pull all the stops out. And they've been successful in that. But it's come at a cost to them. I mean, 20% of the revenue they get from hosting fees from the circuits. But the circuits can only afford to pay the hosting fees, firstly, if the government's, by and large, underwriting them, and they can sell tickets. And without the fans, Liberty were faced in a situation where they had to waive a lot of the hosting fees. And then we got to the situation where we had to go racing elsewhere. They got to pay the circuits. So instead of receiving money, they're paying the circuits to host the races. So it's had a dramatic effect on their bottom line. And they're not really that profitable as such in Formula One. So I think it's just a case for them really to get through the year.
And do you think that these costs that they're kind of going to end up incurring as a result of this truncated season, do you think that's part of the decision perhaps to go to Saudi Arabia next season and extend the calendar to 23 races? And you know, we hear that they have these aims for 25 as well.
I don't think it's anything to do with the pandemic. That ball was in motion long before the pandemic. I mean, Liberty Media has this aggressive standpoint of increasing the number of races on the calendar, which, you know, has its opposition from the teams in terms of burnout. But in terms of going to the circuits like Saudi Arabia, I mean, personally, I hope that, I mean, Eccleston, basically, the previous owner, CVC Capital, said to him, you know, maximise the revenue because they wanted to take as much out of the sport and then sell it on. And so Eccleston went to a lot of countries that maybe have a question mark over them morally. And he went there because they could pay these just huge fees. So Saudi Arabia and countries like that coming onto the circuit, You know, it's like we've seen this year with the European circuits, some of the great heritage and history. Liberty's claiming to try and balance the new circuits against the heritage, and I can understand that, and they need to go to countries like Vietnam and other places around the world. But I don't think we can put it in the pandemic. It's purely about the fees. I mean, Vietnam, interestingly, not funded by the Vietnamese government, but by a private individual, paying in the region of $50 million. Saudi are paying about $60 million. These are astronomical sums of money, nothing like the European circuits can compete with.
No, and I suppose, as you say, that is really the balance that they need to strike. And it'll be interesting to see if they're able to do that, especially now that potentially they've kind of opened Pandora's box a little bit with regards to some of these European circuits and some of the more traditional ones. But I guess on a more broader point about Liberty Media, you know, we're kind of 3 years into their ownership of Formula One now, and I think we've seen some rather drastic changes in the way they just conduct themselves comparison to Bernie Eccleston and his ownership. But what's your overall impression of the way that Liberty have kind of worked in their opening 3 years in charge?
To be honest, I think Liberty didn't really have a clue what they were buying. They were blindsided by the TV side to, and they own the Atlantic Braves baseball team, which is part of the Major League Baseball series in America, which is all fairly well run, and the teams all are fairly harmonious in how they deal. So I don't think they realised what they were buying in terms of the product was supplied by 10 teams, which, you know, Ron Dennis didn't call it the Piranha Club for no reason. So I think, and they bought the series without being allowed to do proper due diligence. So there was quite a lot that came out the woodwork for them. So I think, you know, and they had this rather naive approach that they would just go to all these destination cities and everything would be wonderful. The TV money would follow. To be fair to them, you know, they have evolved. They have got to grips, and I think we've got to give them credit for the signing the new Concord Agreement, which, and all the things that should be positive about that. Budget caps, new regulations. So I think they're on the right track. And I mean, a big thing was there wasn't racing in their blood. Their TV media people, and I think Ross Brawn coming on board, you know, brings that element to it. Now we've got Dominic, I can never pronounce his name.
Domenicali.
Yeah. He's coming on board now. So I think that's a huge step forward. I think that they've got a stable base to work from now. But it's what they'll do with the TV. They've got this balance. I mean, it's 40% of their revenues, and they've got the balance between pay TV or free to air. And for them, they get more revenue from the pay TV, but it's expensive eyeballs, which then damages the sponsorship side. I think they'll continue going down the pay TV road. I mean, if you take on their own backyard in America, I mean, they're looking, in one of their big competitors there is Disney. Disney have the rights to the National Football League. To put it into context, they only have the rights on a Monday night, so it's like the highlights, and they pay $2 billion a year. And now they're going to try and get the Sunday night highlights and pay something like $3 billion. So that's kind of where Liberty's head is. It's about the finances. With those sort of monies involved, then they hope. And then, of course, they'll pass that down to the teams, which should make the teams more financially stable. So that's kind of their thinking, and they're hoping. The sponsors are less important to Liberty Media than they are to the teams. But I think Liberty's hoping that if they put the show on, then the sponsors will follow.
And I suppose a big part of the kind of financial health of the sport going forward is the impending budget cap, which is going to come in for the start of the 2021 season, and then also the 2022 regulations, which are less, I suppose, related to the budget cap, but more to the actual spectacle of the sport. And there's obviously been a push there to make a kind of more dynamic and entertaining racing product. But what are your thoughts with regards to the budget cap, with the level of that it's at, and just how much of an impact that will be in terms of bringing down the cost of Formula One?
Yeah, well, the cynic in me argues how much will they be able to police it and enforce it. I mean, you know, these teams, and you know, there's a lot of unscrupulous people involved in Formula One. We've seen that over the years, all the scandals, and we even see it just now with all the alleged, you know, Ferrari engine and Racing Point copying, and you know what Haas is up to. So Formula One teams can employ the best engineers and aerodynamicists and PR people, lawyers, so why would they not employ the best accountants and circumvent some of the rules? I know that's a rather negative viewpoint, but that's what may happen in practice, that they put more into the engine development, which is not part of the budget cut, you know, they go way around it. On the general principle, I mean, there's two schools of thought. I mean, you're taken from the budget cut is kind of like a government-imposed communist, we'll control the marketplace, compared to what we have just now, which is the complete opposite, which is the complete free market. So it's trying to find the balance somewhere in the middle. I mean, lots of other sports don't have budget caps. Lots of other sports, you know, if we take Premiership football in this country, you've got, you know, your Man United's and Chelsea's. You know, abroad, you've got your Inter Milan's, Real Madrid's, you know. So it's not unique to Formula One, the disparity on budgets. So it could be argued that, on one hand, the budget caps prevent in progress because the teams that are successful can't reinvest because they're hampered by this cap. So it's a strange one. I think the jury's out on it, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that given the level that it's been placed at and the exemptions that teams will be able to enjoy, especially as it first starts before the kind of reductions come in and potential talk of a driver salary cap comes in, I think in terms of the overall impact on the competition will potentially be limited. But I suppose it is an encouraging move by Liberty. And I think, as you say, with the kind of way that the new Concorde agreement has worked, it looks like Formula One is trying to move towards that kind of more American franchise model. And then obviously the budget cap comes in hands with that.
The budget cap adds value to the teams. It makes them more saleable. Part of the reason a lot of the people signed up to the Concorde Agreement, because a lot of these teams will still get sold over the next 5 years. I mean, it's a bit of a myth that nobody will buy a Formula One team. There's plenty of purchasers out there. And the new Concorde Agreement just made them far more valuable with the dilution fund, you know, which will prevent or potentially prevent new entrants. So it's made the teams more valuable. So from there, from a self-interest point of view, if they're looking part of their game strategy, I mean, you know, Williams New Order owners Darlington Capital, they've only bought that team to eventually sell it. And there's no other reason for it. So, it's interesting they didn't sign till the budget cap was agreed.
Well, it's a good segue, I suppose, into our next topic, because there was some speculation that George Russell could be replaced potentially by Sergio Perez. So what do you make of the latest driver market rumours and moves?
Yeah, well, we had the announcement today of Alfa Tauri with a Japanese driver maybe potentially getting signed up. I mean, I think all the names are in the ring. There's fewer seats now available. We're waiting to see how it shakes out. So we've got Schumacher, probably going to Haas, and then it's really whether Perez and Hülkenberg will get a seat. It's a bit disappointing, to be honest, that, you know, some of the young guns, there seems to be a lot of them coming through the ranks, and, you know, we're re-signing the Raikkonens and Alonsos and Vettels of the world, much that I respect all of those individuals. You know, the sport needs to attract the young drivers, and if the driver academies that soak up a lot of the money aren't producing the goods, or they are producing the goods, but then there's no outlet for the drivers, that's not good for the sport.
In terms of Sergio Perez, is another one potentially looking at Red Bull. Do you have any understanding of kind of what the situation is in terms of like the money and that these drivers can bring, and kind of how the teams look at that and how they kind of weigh that against their decisions in terms of talent?
There's always been, I mean, we talk about these pay drivers. There's always been pay drivers in the whole history of this sport. Drivers have always bought sponsorship to them. Your Niki Lauders of the world, you know, Enzo Ferrari couldn't re-sign him unless he, you know, Paramount would pull the money out unless they re-signed him after Lauder fell out with Enzo over his salary. So we've always had them. They'll always continue. The only slight difference is if a driver was talented, then the money would follow him by the sponsors. You could argue with the breed of drivers now, you know, your Strolls and your Lafittis, where it's their father's money, you could argue that they don't need the talent because the dad's still going to pay out the money, whereas a commercial sponsor wouldn't. I mean, I have a great sympathy with the pay drivers that have got the rich fathers putting them through the sport, because I think they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they don't get anywhere, it's, well, they're only in it because of their dad's money, and if they do get anywhere, it's, well, they only got there because of their dad's money. So I think that's quite hard. The teams look at it, I mean, it really depends on the harsh financial reality. Some teams need the money more than others, so it's a much more critical factor than their decision-making. Teams like Red Bull tend not to worry on that factor, nor do Mercedes. But then lower down the end of the grid, your Haases and your Williams and whatever, then it can be a critical part of the decision. And a lot of times the sponsorship, the money comes is that the sponsor just pays the driver, so the teams don't have to pay the driver, and that's how that deal's structured, as opposed to the team getting the money directly. It just means they don't have a salary bill to pick up.
And you've mentioned sponsorship a couple of times, and I'd just be interested to get your thoughts on that. Firstly, do you think that there's going to be an impact from COVID-19 on the way that teams attract sponsors? And, you know, are there any interesting sponsorship opportunities that you can kind of see opening up?
I think it's going to be very, very hard now. I think the world's moving on post-COVID. I think you'll find that companies will reevaluate what they're getting out of their money. I think it's going to get harder and harder and harder. Formula One's still able to attract sponsors, which is the positive thing, and Liberty Media's sort of title partners have held up, although it'd be interesting to see if Heineken re-sign their contracts out at the end of the year. You've got Emirates, that, you know, an airline, you know, they're just in meltdown. So they will attract the sponsors, and there's different sponsorship models available to the teams. I mean, McLaren's certainly went down the road of no title sponsor, whereas they have 48 smaller sponsors, which enables them to have a greater degree of flexibility, and, you know, the sums add up to greater than a title sponsor. So I think sponsorship will still be there. It might just have to evolve. I think what everybody will find is there'll just be less money per sponsorship deal. But that's kind of negated with the budget cap. That's one of the whole sort of driving forces behind it. There's going to be less money coming at the sport. So if you have to spend less, you need less income. I'm not pessimistic about the sponsors. I just think you'll find it'll be a lot more creative how they use their sponsorship dollar.
And just before we go, Gary, just one last question. Obviously, the movement from Ross Brawn and Liberty seems to just be with an eye, I suppose, on making the racing more entertaining. The reverse grids is one thing that we've seen floated a number of times now, which seems to be kind of losing traction, if anything, among the teams. Do you think there's going to be a continued push from Brawn and from Liberty and the kind of people at the top of Formula One to keep bringing in these ideas to try and make the racing a little bit more engaging?
I campaigned last year for fans to have more involvement in Formula One. I do believe that all the stakeholders in Formula One, from Liberty Media to the teams to the sponsors, they miss a fundamental part of their business model, is that they're delivering a poor product to their customers. We wouldn't put up with it in any other product that we were purchasing. We give up our time to watch the sport. If the fans didn't watch the sport, there just would be no sport. It's as simple as that. There'd be no money in it. You know, sponsors only come in it because we watch it. If every football match at a weekend ended in a 0-0 draw, then football would soon die. And yet we're expected to put up with our product being poor. So they really, really need to, I would say, in all the decisions they make, when they design circuits, when they design cars, when they bring in regulations, the first and foremost thing, consideration should be, is this good for racing? Is this good for fans? So they have no choice. They need to increase that. They need to keep the product going. And when we talk about, the Mercedes domination's boring, but I've sat through all the dominations, whether it was Red Bull, Ferrari, Williams. The Formula One's always been like that. That's not the issue. It's if there's a lack of racing on the tracks and these teams aren't held to account. I don't personally think the reverse grid is a good situation, a good scenario. I think if you're going to introduce things, you've got to keep the spirit of what racing's about. I don't think you can come up with, and they're easily put off as gimmicks. I'm not saying that they're a gimmick, but anything that negates, you know, I just think the reverse grids are not a good solution. But there's plenty of other solutions out there they could do. There's lots of very simple things they could do to make the racing more exciting. And sometimes I hold my head in my hands to see why don't they do it.
Well, thank you very much, Gary, for your wonderful insight. And I hope to have you back on the podcast very shortly. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week to preview the Turkish Grand Prix. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, please just drop us an email at podcast@grandprix247.com, or you can visit our website, grandprix247.com. Thanks very much, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.